Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Joe Epstein. It is my pleasure to introduce Chris Matthews and Professor David Kennedy. As a child growing up in a Republican family in Pennsylvania, Chris not only developed a deep interest in politics, but a surprising fascination with the young and upcoming Democrat from Massachusetts. His name is John F. Kennedy. And Chris's new book, Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero, is a great testament to the complex political and personal life of our nation's 35th president. Widely known for his lively and straightforward interviews and political commentary, Chris is the host of MSNBC's Hardball and NBC's The Chris Matthews Show. He spent 13 years at the Washington Bureau as Washington Bureau Chief for the San Francisco Examiner, which at the time was a Hearst-owned newspaper, and was also a syndicated columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle. Chris started his career in politics, working 15 years on Capitol Hill. He served as a top aide to former Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill and was a White House aide and speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter. He is the author of several best-selling books, including Hardball, Now Let Me Tell You What I Really Think, and Kennedy and Nixon. Chris Matthews is a two-time recipient of the Washington Post's Crystal Ball Award, and this is given for successful predictions of U.S. elections. Chris is not an ordinary journalist. He has a well-earned reputation as a political commentator and a person who is balanced and an independent thinker, and who has supported ideas from both sides of the aisle. And despite spending much of his early political career serving on the staff of a U.S. president and at least four Democratic members of Congress, he admits voting for George W. Bush in 2000. And Chris has stated, and I quote, that I am more conservative than people say I am. Chris is married to ABC News anchor Kathleen Matthews, and they have three children. Our moderator tonight, who will be in conversation with Chris Matthews, is Professor David Kennedy, the Donald J. McLachlan Professor of History, Emeritus at Stanford University, and he's the co-director of the Bill Lane Center for the American West and a Pulitzer Prize winner for his book, Freedom from Fear. David Kennedy and Chris Matthews will be in conversation tonight. So if you'll please give a welcome, a warm welcome, to both of them.
Chris, I hope you appreciate that warm California welcome.
I do.
But on that note, I have a bone to pick with you.
Okay.
We're seated here in the shadow of Stanford University, from which your institution, your wife, has a degree.
Right.
And here we're here to discuss your biography of Jack Kennedy, in which I find no mention of the fact that he matriculated at Stanford for 3 months in 1940. Can you explain that, please?
Well, I think he was auditing courses. he was actually driving up and down the main highway out here, Camino Real, having fun. He had a convertible.
Stanford students still do that.
Enjoying life. By the way, my wife graduated in 75. I was from Stanford. She's from Los Altos. And Kathleen said her favorite professor was David Kennedy.
Well, I want to begin by quoting a very powerful sentence you write on page 9 of your book. where you're bringing the reader into your own relationship with John F. Kennedy. And you put it very colorfully. You say, JFK was wired into our central nervous system and juiced us. Now, as I read this book, that's what it's about, is the effect that he had on what I'm going to broadly call our generation and the kind of legacy he left. It's interesting to me that the book, though it presents itself as a biography, less than 20% of it is about the presidency. It's really about Kennedy's formation as a young man and as a political leader. Yeah. And then you end with a very wonderful account of the Cuban Missile Crisis in particular. But it seems to me your interest really is not the presidency so much as how this person became the man, the human being, and eventually the political leader and the president that he was. So that's the way I read the book. Maybe also some expiation for your childhood flirtation with Barry Goldwater. But
Hillary Clinton. We had that in common.
Is that an accurate reading? That was this
yeah, it's a Bildungsroman. It's a novel. It's a way of understanding growth, how a person grew from Joe Kennedy's son to being the man who had the detachment and judgment to get us through the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I wanted to try to figure out how he got from there to there, and to see the development from firsthand witnesses at Choate, at Harvard, at in the Navy, and later on in his early political career. And my goal was to answer the question, what's he like? And he said that was the reason people read biography. And I thought I'd try to turn it on him using the method of people I trust as witnesses. I had no drive-by or very few drive-by witnesses. They were all people that you get to know in the book and make your judgment about their judgments and witnesses, and so that you really get a sense of him being in the room with you. I got a call the other day from Edmund Reggie from Louisiana, who was one of his allies, and he said, you brought him back alive. Hmm. And it was kind of a hologram. So I took the 12 people that knew him very well, including Jacqueline, and had them all give their perspective on him so that he would come alive in the middle of the round table. And that's how I thought I could figure out who he was, because he lived in compartments. And no one really knew him completely. Jackie knew him as well as anyone, but he didn't live with everybody. He didn't share his friends with each other. He kept them all separate and his associates. So he was able to move freely from one part of his life to another without any kind of restriction. And he lived a very free life that way. And I wanted to try to capture him among those people.
You know, among the people that we certainly associate in memory very closely with Jack Kennedy was his longtime aide, speechwriter Ted Sorensen.
Yeah.
Ted Sorensen was here at the Commonwealth Club a year or so ago before he died, talking about his book. And among the things that came out in that conversation and his reminiscences about Kennedy is they virtually never socialized together.
Yeah, he was dismissed around 6 at night, as were the Irish Mafia. Jack's friends were his elite friends. He had only people of second-generation wealth. Fred Fay was the closest friend up out here from Woodside, probably the closest to a middle-class guy, and he wasn't middle-class. He was pretty well off. And most of his friends were like David Ormsby Gore or Ben Bradley or Shari Bartlett, who was sixth-generation Yale, and Ben Cruninshield Bradley, who was an old Yank in many ways. And they were his friends he was comfortable with. And the Irish guys he worked with, they got him elected. They had nothing to do with his social life. He led a very compartmentalized life, and Ted Sorensen understood that. And he said, I enjoyed the part I shared with him. But for 4 years, from 56 to 60 and through 60, those two guys were in an airplane together. Imagine that experience for 4 years. I mean, he was really in love with Jack. I mean, he loved the guy. And just two of them flying around together, yeah, just exploring America and trying to pick up on the zeitgeist so that they could develop the message which would give the country to them in 60, at a time when the country wasn't bad off. There was no real reason for a big transition in 60. And they were able to convince the country to go to this young guy at 43. It was an amazing election to win. You know, Nixon was tough.
I found that among the most interesting parts of your book, about that long several years when Kennedy and Sorensen were on the road together and going to every nook and cranny of America, and building what you call, I think rightly, the Kennedy Party. It's
right.
A party within a party. And I just happened to notice in your piece in Time magazine, yesterday's date, you take Obama to fault for not putting together an Obama party.
He doesn't have one.
Yeah.
Right now, if you were to, if Eddie Rendell, the former governor of Pennsylvania, were to pick up the phone and it was Bill Clinton, he'd say, Hillary's going for it. He'd be moving. They would be moving together. They could have that army on the march in a matter of hours, the Clinton party, right now. There is no Obama party. Hmm. He has no confederates. I've never seen a politician like him. I watch the Sunday shows like you all do and Meet the Press and the other shows, and I never see somebody come on and take a punch for Obama or deliver one for him. They're all independent people. They're all members of Congress. Liberals and middle-of-the-roaders are on their own. He seems to enlist no companionship politically. I don't get it. I mean, it's not the hardest part of politics to enlist friends to have them march with you and support you when you're down, and he's been down. And the Kennedys from the beginning recruited their own party because the political establishment in Cambridge, Massachusetts was all against them. They had their own people they wanted to run, Tip O'Neill and the rest of them. And so Tip noticed them. Well, I sat with many an hour in the afternoon, just he and I in the back room, and he would tell about how they built their own political party. And it was built in a Machiavellian way, asking people to do things for them. And every time somebody did something for the Kennedys, they became a Kennedy person. The key to politics, to political power, is to ask people to do things for you. And once they've done it, they're invested in you. It's not giving people things. That's not the way you build political power. Gratitude is rare, but no one forgets what they've done for someone else. And that's why they understood it. Like parenthood, and the secretary works for the boss for 30 years. Who's the most loyal? The secretary to the boss. Who's the most caring? The parent. Because the more you invest in a human relationship, the more you are loyal to it. And Machiavelli figured that out 500 years ago. The Kennedys knew it. And very few politicians. Obama doesn't seem to get it, that the key to power is the loyalty instilled by letting people serve you. He's never asked this country to do anything. In 3 years, he got elected, and the day he was elected, he was inaugurated, rather, he dismissed us. Thank you for giving me the job. Now watch how smart I am. It's not the way to run the country. You have to ask. Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country is the key to the right kind of power, I think.
You know, that is, of course, one of the most famous phrases we all remember from Kennedy's lifetime. Seems to me you've got a scoop about the origin.
Yeah, I went back to Choate and found my way into the archives at Choate, where he was at high school and boarding school, and the Irish have taken over Choate, so I was able to get in, and you could too. And they've taken over that old Yankee institution. Ed Shanahan is the headmaster when I was up there, and Lorraine Connolly was the public relations person. And so she took me into her kid was at Holy Cross where I went, and her husband or something, she had some connection, and got me into the back room into the archives of the school. And this very stiff archivist, and they're always very stiff and reserved, she handed very grudgingly, begrudgingly, she held me in her hand a black loose leaf binder and gave it to me. You know, they don't like to give it to you, this stuff. It's their jewels. And I opened it up, and on the right-hand side was the hymns for the day, and then something called Dean Briggs' essay. It was the essay of the Dean of Studies at Harvard at the turn of the 19th century. And at the bottom of it was a little admonition to the students, which apparently George St. John, the headmaster, would give every couple of years or twice a year. And it was, the youth should always ask of his alma mater, not what she can, quote, not, and then there's an internal quote mark, not what she can do for him, but what he can do for her. And there it is, the phraseology that I'd been told, that Ted Sorensen, you mentioned, thought it was from there, but he checked it out and they wouldn't tell him. But I was able to get there, which proves the old Woody Allen rule, 80% of life is showing up. You have to go, all journalism is going to the spot and asking for it. They will not mail it to you. They will not give it to you on the phone. It's like I tell my kids with jobs, don't send a resume, send you. You go, you'd be there, and maybe you'll be there in that 2 weeks when the job's open. Yeah, yeah. If you're there, then you'll get it. If you're not, you won't.
Let's go back to this Kennedy Party concept.
Yeah, it was true all the way through his career. I mean, he was able to take on, in 1960, of course, the Eleanor Roosevelt residue of the old New Deal Party was still alive, and they were very loyal, of course, and she was too, Adlai Stevenson. And out here in the California Democratic Party, the Democratic Council was so loyal to Stevenson, as you know. And Pat Brown had to deal with that back then. He was always wary of the old liberals who were so loyal to Stevenson and to the old guard. And then on Capitol Hill, you had Lyndon Johnson running his powerhouse. So Kennedy had to create his own alternative to those two to build a national political. And he went around the country and collected 30,000 index cards of people rated 1 to 10 on how much they liked them. And he and Sorensen did that individually. They built a national political movement of individual personal relationships. It's really incredible hard work. For a guy who had a really bad back, a really bad stomach, and had Addison's disease, and all these other diseases that were just haunting him, and he's dragging himself around. He would tell Ted Sorensen in that last book he wrote, he had it that every once in a while I'm just going to have to take a couple of days off and lie down and be sick because or otherwise I'll kill myself. Yeah. He was so vulnerable to his diseases. What a story. He kept it all from us, of course.
Candidates today still have to do a version of pretty intense retail politics like this, but it's concentrated in a couple of places like New Hampshire and Iowa to a much greater degree. The striking thing about your account, and it reflects your own long-time involvement in the mechanics and nuts and bolts, and basic blocking and tackling of politics, is just how intensive and long-term that retail effort was. You say a 30,
yeah, and Jack said that the key to politics, when he began to, a couple of the archival things I dug up, besides the stuff about where the speech came from and the 64 audio tapes of Kenny O'Donnell's account of every race they were through with Sandy Van Oker, his daughter got to me and transcribed for me. And Jack began his memoirs somewhere around 1960. And he described his early campaigning, and he said the key to politics is starting early. And he compared it to commercial advertising. He said, why does Coca-Cola, which everybody knows exists, constantly advertise? Why did Lucky Strike in those days constantly advertise when everyone knows there's a Lucky Strike cigarette? It's not about name ID. They know it. It's you must constantly remind people of these products because people have other things on their mind besides politics. And he said you must start real early in order to win. He said it's the key to politics is long, laborious effort. That's what Jack Kennedy said. It wasn't very glamorous, but he believed that's how he won those races, putting pins on the map, beating Henry Cabot Lodge by going to areas in Massachusetts the Democrats had never gone before. They always counted on a big vote in Boston, and then they would try to take on the rest of the state. Well, Kennedy and Kenny O'Donnell went around to the small communities in suburban areas and exurbia areas where there were some Democrats or potential Democrats who were maybe Irish and upper class or upper middle class who were lawyers from Harvard or BC, but they were still voted Democrat occasionally. But he had to go to them, and that's what they did. They went around and found the people, went to them, asked them to vote for him, and when the election came in, he had beaten the unbeatable Henry Cabot Lodge in 1952.
You mentioned
and he shouldn't have beaten him. There's nothing wrong with Lodge.
Well, Kennedy acknowledged that himself.
Yeah, the Lodge was a great man. And he brought Eisenhower to the nomination and then to the presidency almost single-handedly.
You just mentioned or touched on the matter of Kennedy's chronic and several illnesses. You want to say a little more about that?
Well, you could cry if you understood the guy. And I say in the book that he was a far greater hero than he ever let us know. I mean, he's young. He has scarlet fever. He has asthma. He has what, for a long time in high school, they thought was leukemia. And so he's always having his blood count tested, and his mother never visits him. His mother has no time for him, apparently. And Jackie said a week after he was dead, that notes I was able to get from her interview with Theodore White that never got published, she never loved him. She liked being the mayor's daughter, the ambassador's wife, but never loved him. And that was Jackie's view of Rose Kennedy. And Jack was much more merciless. He said his mother was a nothing. That was his description of her. Very religious, though. Anyway, pretty frightening youth, I'd say. Very much an old English kind of youth. And sent away to school with no love. And even though he was dying, he thought he never had his mother visit him. And I got this from the accounts, actually, of the students at the school who would, one of the kids in a survey taken on their 50th reunion said he couldn't believe the parents never showed up. And so he's sick then, and he had something wrong with his stomach. Nobody knew what it was. It was called a knot. He said it was a knot in his stomach, and it never went away. And they thought it was leukemia. Then they thought it was colitis. I guess it was colitis. And he was getting steroids. You read Bob Dowick, the great historian Bob Dowick. He got the medical records, and steroids that he was taking for years for the colitis really got to his bone structure, began to degenerate. That was his real problem. It wasn't being hit by the Japanese destroyer so much. That was just sort of closing in on what had already been done. He was, he shouldn't have never been checked out for approved for service in the PTs, but he was able to sneak in basically with the help of his father, the senator from Massachusetts, David I. Walsh, and he was able to get PT service. But here's a guy that, had to sleep on either a table or a sheet of plywood, because he couldn't stand sleeping on a regular bed. He had to wear a sciatic corset. And all the time in the Navy, he was dressed like this, and people would see him like this. And he'd be running around saying, "Can I have a needle and thread? I got to work on my corset, fix my back." And it got much worse after they were rammed by and cut in half by the Japanese destroyer. And he was in the hospital for the whole next year, 1944. You can't find anything about him except he's in the hospital. He got down to about 125 pounds. Torby McDonald, his old roommate from Harvard, comes to see him and said, "How you feeling?" He said, "Pretty good considering the shape I'm in." And he always laughed at, obviously, a great World War II guy. Like World War II guys here, you never complain. Never complained about it. Ever complained about his health. And then he got the Addison's disease, which had been haunting him, came in 1947, the first time he had the last rites. He was in London. Pamela Harriman got him to the hospital. The doctor said, "This kid doesn't have a year to live." He had it strike him again in 51. He was in the Far East with Bobby on a Far Eastern trip. And Bobby actually first became interesting to Jack that time because Bobby saved him. He became his protector that trip and got into a military base in Okinawa. And he had the second episode of Addison's. He had the last rites again. Of course, he had the last rites again in 54 when he had the back operation, a couple of them that broke bad. Nixon, there's a great scene I was able to get for the earlier book I had done on them. Nixon's Secret Service guy described Nixon's crying in the car for his friend Jack. I mean, it's amazing stories here. I was able to find the real life of these people. And of course, Kennedy lived all his life at the edge. You know, his sister, the one person in his early life he really loved completely was Kathleen, and she was killed in 48. And he just sat there listening to the music. I know who was sitting with him, and he was listening to Finnegan's Rainbow and some Irish singer. And he just said, when they finally got the word on the second call that she was dead, he just said, "Doesn't she have a beautiful voice?" He was a very distant guy, very detached from people, and frighteningly powerful because of it, because he wasn't moved by the emotions of those around him, which actually saved us in 62, because he wasn't moved by the others around him.
You quote his friend Charlie Bartlett.
Yeah.
I'm reading from your book now. He says, "I don't know how to say it, but Jack wasn't sort of in love with humanity. He was cool."
Yeah.
That passage reminded me of a famous remark made 200 years ago about Alexander Hamilton, that he loved his country but not his countrymen.
Yeah. Well, he was cool to the point of frightening him. The thing about it, his ability to rule, to lead, was that Chuck Spalding, had sort of a chemistry relationship with him. He had a lot of interesting buddies. Lem Billings, who he met in high school, who became his first real friend when he was sick and lonely, and actually substituted for his parents. Joe Kennedy would say that Lem moved in with his tattered suitcase then and never left. He had a room at the White House. Now, isn't that interesting? You're married to a person, but you have this other person from your gender who lives with you, who's always there. It's a fascinating story. Everybody just said, "Oh, Lem Billings." And you sort of hear it. If you read all the Kennedy books, like most of us have, you hear this name Lem Billings, you ignore it. Well, Lem Billings lived there. He was his really close friend. And he couldn't stand being alone with Jackie for a whole weekend, so he'd always have a pal show up. Oh yeah, he always had to have somebody else for dinner. And when he was alone and Jackie wasn't there, he would have Dave Powers stay till 11 o'clock at night and put him into bed, and then he'd say his prayers at the bedside. And when Dave told me that years ago, that he said his prayers every night, I said, "Oh yeah, I can't put that in the book. Nobody's going to believe it." Then Jackie put it in her tapes recently about how he would say his prayers. And she sort of looked down on it. She thought it was just superstitious. She wasn't religious, really. And Jack would actually be a real Catholic, and he would go through these devotions of going to confession right to the end. Once again, nobody noticed he did it, but he would go to confession all the time, even if he had to sneak in the line with some other guys with Massachusetts accents so the priest wouldn't know for sure it was him. Because one time the priest said, "Mr. President," he got really turned off by that. But he would light candles. He would go off to when the lost child, Patrick, who died at birth, he was so broken up by that, he would sneak off after the Harvard-Columbia game and go pray at his graveside in Brookline. And it was very difficult for him to pray to kneel, because it always killed him to lean over and pick up something. And he did the same thing with Kathleen. Mark Dalton, his first campaign manager, talked about him lighting candles. He was very old church. He would always go to church in the Navy. Well, when you're facing death in the Navy, it makes sense you'd go to church a lot. But he went a lot. He'd always go to the other island for Mass. He hung around one of these guys, a Princeton grad who was an Augustinian chaplain. He would go to church when he was at Choate all the time. But going to confession right to the end and praying it every night on his knees and never wanting to be alone. He never wanted to be alone, never bored, and never stuck. He couldn't stand being stuck. And he's easy for a guy to identify with in many ways. He is accessible if you read the book. I mean, you'll say, "I can't identify with a prince, but I can get to know this guy. He is somebody I think I know. I think I am in a way. I found him very much like I could figure myself out to be. Without saying I'm Jack Kennedy, I think some of this stuff is very familiar to me as a Catholic. And I told this to the Archbishop of one of our major cities, and I can't say which. I said, how do you figure a guy that's messing around with all these women and yet very devotional? He looked at me like I was crazy, like, what else is new? I think I know these guys, like, by the millions.
Or tell me something
yeah,
I don't know.
Tell me something I don't know. Yeah, exactly, right. And he thought it was sort of, he didn't think that was odd at all, that he prayed every night and was still chasing, you know.
Let's
it's so interesting, and I don't have all the answers, but I find him fascinating.
Let's talk a little more about his Catholicism.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, he was the first Catholic president. In some ways, you could
say... Are
you
Catholic or Protestant?
What do you think?
I think you're Catholic.
You're right.
Okay, yeah. But there are some Irish prods around, you know. My grandma, I grew up with an Irish, Northern Irish woman who was Mrs. Doubtfire. She had the most strongest accent, and she was very formidable. And she was definitely an orange woman. We had all three in our family, English, Irish, and green and orange, the whole thing.
More's the pity.
It was more's the pity. It's like you got it right. It was a small wedding.
But it's a truism about Kennedy. He's the first Catholic president.
Yeah.
But in a sense, you could also say he's the last Catholic president in the sense that his election kind of just took a lot of the wind out of the air out of the balloon of anti-Catholicism. And it transformed, I think, the American Catholic community's sense of itself. Something probably you felt as a young person growing up as I did. What was your family's reaction to that?
Well, we were a Republican family, so I'm not sure how many votes we got. I mean, I was Republican as a kid. My dad was definitely Republican. It's in the book. I asked, Dad, are you voting for Kennedy? And he said, no. And I said, but he's Catholic. He said, yeah, but I'm a Republican. And then I see out here it's not very ethnic, so people don't think like, you know, the neighborhood stuff back east, as you know, but the tribalism isn't so prevalent out here.
That's for
in
sure.
Fact, my wife doesn't even know what I'm talking about when I say Italian. What does that mean? You know, it's Italian. I think the idea of everybody felt that it wasn't just Catholic, it was Jewish people, and a lot of people felt that the door had been swung open in 60, that he opened the door for a lot of people.
Yeah.
In fact, that was the great Kennedy strength, the we aspect of it as opposed to he. It wasn't a solo act. When he came through that door, his whole war generation came through the door. The young officers back to lead, all the Catholics, the Jewish people, the Polish Catholics, the Italians, all the different ethnic groups felt that the door was opening for them, the Lebanese. It was a whole difference. Finally, you didn't have to be a Protestant guy to be running the country. I think it really meant a lot to a lot of people, especially Jewish people. I think they really felt that the monopoly was broken, and it was a very important thing to feel you could be part of a country that wasn't monopolized by one group.
Is it fair to make the analogy that Barack Obama is the first black president and the last black president in the sense, again,
well,
that
I don't know.
Race will not ever again be as big a factor?
He's also an immigrant story, too. I think Barack Obama benefited from the immigrant narrative, too, as well. The African father, and there's a lot of strains. He wasn't just a guy named a southern guy with a regular American name like Joe Washington or somebody from the South that moved north. He didn't have that internal immigration story behind him. He had his own story, Hawaii and the prep school in Hawaii and the Ivy League and the white mother from Kansas and that sort of homegrown Midwestern background. He had a lot of strains to who he is. He does, and maybe that was what's difficult for him. He can do a lot of crossing over, but he doesn't have a lot of penetration. He doesn't really connect with us as well as... He's able to sort of relate to us in a very light way. There's no deep personal thing there,
yeah.
I don't think.
Yeah.
But Kennedy, on the other hand, was still a Mick. And he's still an Irish guy with a certain attitude about the country and the way it should be run, a tough guy's attitude. Bobby definitely was unassimilated. The great line about Bobby, he was wonderfully unassimilated. He was a kid from a James Cagney movie, from the Bowery Boys almost. Tough. And so was Reagan. I met him a few times. He had some of that, too, that Mick attitude. You want to fight? You know.
Didn't Cardinal Cushing tell Kennedy just before his inauguration that you've got some Harvard in you and some Irish, and you better be more Irish than Harvard?
Well, actually, Nixon said that, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Nixon said it. I hope he's more Irish. But I think the religion thing wasn't that religious in the sense of his life. His manner of living was hard to figure. He was obviously taken. The best part of my book is the love stuff with him and Inga Arvid, this Danish movie star he was in love with, and very romantic letters from the South Pacific, and the way he related to her is right out of the movies. And of course, he was right out of the movies. Jack Kenny's a war hero, and he had a tremendous personal sense of responsibility that comes through, that is so unemotional but so dominant in his life. I mean, here's a guy who, when his boat is cut in half at 2 o'clock in the morning, with no radar, no moon, no stars, pitch black, and he instinctively dives out of the part of the boat, the bow that's still surfaced, and he goes looking for the guys that were in the stern. And he finds one guy who's badly burnt, three-quarters of his body, really horribly burnt. Pappy McMahon is 42 years old, the engineer, who had actually sunk down below into the water and had looked up and seen the burning gasoline all around them. And Jack, through all this hell, grabs this guy and pulls him back almost against his will, because the guy said, "I'm giving up." And he said, "No, you're not giving up." And pulls him back by his strength. And he's not a big guy, Jack, to the part of the boat that's still afloat, and it's pretty far away by then. It drifted far, and they're in the high seas. And then he goes and finds this guy, Harris, who's already to give up. His leg's gone or something. It's all messed up. And Jack pulls his sweater off and somehow gets him confident again. He wants to live again. The guy says, "Leave me alone. I'm finished, Kipper." And it's out of the movies, these guys giving up their lives. And he says, "No, you're not giving up your lives." He saves these guys by force of will and gets them on this boat, and he says, "Let's have a vote. We're going to have to decide what to do. There's nothing in the book about this. What do we do?" And this top of the boat has flipped over like a turtle, and they're out in the middle of the seas, and they're in Japanese waters, and they know the Japanese will torture the hell out of you before they kill you. And so they're thinking, he says, "It's up to you guys. I don't have anything to live for." And then one of the other guys, McGuire, who's a Catholic buddy of his, says, he had a lot to live for, but he said, "How many kids? You guys make up the decisions." So they decide to swim for 4 miles to the nearest island. He wanted to pick a small island, Plum Pudding Island, because they didn't think the Japanese would be there. They'd have a few days maybe before they get picked up, before the Japs got them, Japanese got them. And so he says, "You guys," they found a plank, an 8-foot plank. And Jack said, "Okay, the 4 guys that can't swim, hang on to this thing. And the 5 guys that can't swim, hang on this. And don't separate under waters." He wanted to make sure the non-swimmers were going to make it. And then he pulled out his knife and cut the strap of Pappy McMahon's life jacket and put it in his teeth. And as Pappy said afterwards, it was like he'd done this all his life. It's like the scene in front of the hospital in The Godfather when Michael lights the cigarette lighter and he looks at his hand and realizes it's not shaken. And he just puts this strap in his mouth, and for 4 hours he carries this guy on his back, and his back is terrible shape. And Pappy doesn't even know how bad off his back is. He just, with force of will, saves this guy's life. And he ends up on the beach and he vomits. He's exhausted. And the next thing he knows, he's got a .38 pistol and a lantern, a flashlight, and he's heading out into the channel again to try to flag down a PT boat that night. And he gets swept away, ends up on another island, swims back the next morning, gets these guys, swims to another island, same thing with Pappy on his back, then swims to another island and finally finds water and brings it back. It's an amazing human story of commitment and courage. And word of this kind of behavior gets around.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think it's the first sign in his life he was in true command. And anybody here who's been in the service knows this, when you really get confidence and you can lead men in battle and lead them into battle and home safely. And he was able to do that. And from there became... Also, he got to hang around for the first time in his life with the non-elite. They had the weed leaguers, not just the Ivy Leaguers. The guys from Ohio State and, you know, different big, good state universities and places. They called themselves the weed leaguers. And he got to know other guys. They were all pretty elite, but they were all college guys, which was a big deal in that generation, just to be a college guy. But, you know, he got to know a lot of guys it made him much more democratic. And when he went to run for Congress, he was able to do it. Meet people.
You don't do it explicitly in the book, but you've done it here this evening. You certainly did it in your Time magazine piece, is to use John F. Kennedy, whom you clearly admire, as a kind of measuring rod to take the measure of the current president and the current state of the country. So a lot of the questions that have come up off the floor here from the audience, they go to that comparison. So I'll just give you a sample of one of them and see what you have to say about it. He said, "How do you think JFK would have fared in today's Twitter and YouTube media world? And today's extreme ideology of the Republican Congress?"
Well, it was a better time back then. I think he would have adjusted. You know, So if you're talking about his personal life, he would have adjusted. I think he would have been very good at it. I think some people are classics. I mean, I don't know how many nights I've stayed up. In the old days, I used to drink white wine, enjoy myself, and watch an old movie. And I don't think Humphrey Bogart's ever going to be out of style. And or William Holden or any of those guys, Clark Gable, they're always going to be just as great as they were the day we met them. Or Catherine Hepburn or any of them, and or Grace Kelly. They're always going to be great. And Jack Kennedy would always be great. He could walk on the stage right now and he'd be Jack Kennedy and blow us away. I think Bill Clinton's like that. I don't think he's exactly as classy, but he is classic.
Classic
he's
or classy? Classy.
He's a recognizable figure. But he is beyond charm. I mean, Jackie said, she called him magic, as like a second person. Okay, magic. Because he would walk into a room and just, the room would swoon.
Yeah.
Men and women both. And he would just, and it started, and Jackie would say that about it. Of course, Jack called it his big P, his big personality. He'd put it on when he had to walk into a room. He would adopt into this sort of higher level of charm. He would laugh about it, but he knew he had it.
So, but you know,
I think it would work today, and I think we'd love it. And Obama's got a bit of it, a bit of the charm. That smile is magic. I don't think he has the we part. He has the he part, not the we part. Yeah. Being a leader is not the same as being a star.
Yeah.
You can be a star without being a leader. And I guess you can be a leader without being a star. And we've had generals like that. And I think we've had generals who are stars like Patton, but they're not all stars.
But it could be said about Kennedy, if you want to stretch out the comparison to today's electronic media environment and how it's changed so many ways we relate to each other, that he was really the first politician who figured out how to make maximum political use out of what was in that day a brand new technology, which is television.
He took his first class in 1952. CBS was offering a class to politicians in how to use television. He had a speech coach right up until the great debates. I talk about him in my book. He wasn't a great speaker up until the election. He was pretty bad, in fact. He got better. Nixon agreed to debate him after watching him out here in Los Angeles at the Coliseum. And that last night of the Democratic Convention, Nixon said, I can beat that guy. He can't give a speech in public. And he did give a terrible, it wasn't a great speech, the one where he introduced the New Frontier. He wasn't good. It was blowing away in the wind. He was tired. It wasn't a great night for him. So, in a way, his serendipity worked for him. Nixon was sucked into agreeing to a debate with him. If he hadn't, he would have beaten him, probably. Kennedy was a star in that first minutes because he did have certain rhetorical abilities they don't have today. He walked out onto that stage in Chicago at Studio B, at the CBS affiliate there, and gave an 8-minute opening statement that won the election, I'm convinced. He just did it right in front of Nixon and blew him away. He said, tonight's topic is domestic policy, but let's not kid ourselves. What we do here in this country decides how well we do in the world. And just Nixon said, what happened here? He just took away my issue. And then for the rest of the debate, Nixon kept saying, I agree with the spirit in which the senator is speaking. He's right in principle. In fact, they gave it away. He just didn't have the debate that night.
I think, and I'm sure a lot of people share the opinion, that Nixon and Kennedy are just about totally opposite personalities. But as you detail, they actually had quite a high regard for each other.
Well, I just have the facts. They had their first debate in 1947. In McKeesport, Pennsylvania, they took the Capital Limited by train out there. They were recognized to be pals, having sitting around at the burgers afterwards and talking sports. And they couldn't, the local people couldn't believe how friendly they were. They took the train back at midnight to Washington. They flipped the coin or whatever for who got the bottom bunk. It's not exactly North by Northwest, but aspects of it. I'm sure they didn't go through the tunnel, but I would love to have seen that right now, that picture of those two guys back from the war, junior naval officers talking about the coming Cold War, all through the night, talking, top bunk, the lower bunk, about a war that didn't have a name until 2 weeks later when Bernard Brooke gave it its name, the Cold War. And they were very aware, both of them, of what was coming and what had to be done to avoid another war.
So they sized each other up very
early.
Yeah,
well, they were
on.
The two smart guys in the class.
Yeah. We've lost that sense of Nixon, I think, although our
Nixon became embittered and broke bad, but you know it was just taken to extreme some of the methods of politics that he should have never done. He got very bitter.
Well, again,
but Kennedy, I talked to Jean Smith last summer, Kennedy's last sibling, and she said that Kennedy believed that Nixon was the most brilliant man in the Senate.
Yeah.
These are facts. He told Charlie Bartlett, the guy who introduced him to Jackie Kennedy, the New Year's Eve before the election in 1960, that if he lost the primaries, he's voting for Nixon. Hmm. These are all in the fact. These are facts I came upon. Hmm. And you can connect the dots, and you can be uncomfortable with these facts. He was the guy that walked over with the campaign contribution to Nixon when he ran against Helen Douglas. He couldn't stand Helen Douglas.
Yeah.
And
Joe Sr. wrote a check for the Nixon campaign.
And he delivered it by hand.
Yeah.
Jack did. He liked Nixon, and he and Smathers and those guys all were cold warriors back then. And
well,
he changed.
We have a lot of questions here that go in the direction of comparing then and now. So not just Kennedy as a campaigner in the modern media environment, but what would he, to make it explicit here, the questioner asks, what hope or direction do you think JFK would give to us today that would help us to get this country back on track, or to use the phrase he used in the 60 campaign, to get the country moving again?
Well, I think he had three things going for him. One is it's a we. It was always sort of a war effort. It was sort of, I think, a resuscitation of the World War II feeling. When everybody here, we can remember World War II, it was a war effort. It wasn't just the fighting guys on the front. Everybody did something. You accepted rationing. You collected metal. You collected rubber. You know, you did your bit. You bought war bonds. There was a sense of everybody together and everybody doing their bit, or else you weren't really patriotic. We don't have that. Nobody asks us to do anything anymore. Obama never asked us to do anything.
Neither did
he.
George
asked some
Bush.
Kids to help him get reelected, but he doesn't ask the American people, his grown-ups, to join him in something. He never asks. Kennedy was always asking. The troops were called up in the Berlin crisis. We had the Peace Corps. We had the Special Forces. Everything about was us. We were always called to arms. We were part of something that was happening. You could feel the new frontier. Today, unless your kid's in the military, nobody feels anything in these wars we're fighting or what we're going through economically. It's all like, yeah, every man for himself. And it's not, there's no sense of national brotherhood or sisterhood right now like there was as recently as the 60s. He also had a vision. He also had an optimism, which was, look at how we've turned the space program around. And he had exhibits right in front of us. We could see the Apollo program developing, the Saturn rockets. The week after he's dead, Jackie said that the one thing she wanted besides the eternal flame was a little initial of Jack Kennedy on the next Saturn rocket, because he wanted so much to beat the Soviets in the space race. That's what he wanted to do. He wanted to win the Cold War without war. He was so positive about what we could do with the Alliance for Progress, with Latin America, what we could do with the Peace Corps, how we could win this battle for the minds and hearts of the world without going to war. It was so wonderful. I mean, I'm a cheerleader for it. I thought it was great. And the more I look back and I say, why can't we do that? He'd also say, we always have a few. You know where Kennedy was taking us? When he got killed, he was fighting for civil rights. It's in the book how he was working with Daley to try to put pressure on the Judiciary Committee, to get it through Judiciary and then through Rules Committee. He was trying to get Medicare through. He was trying to get a tax cut through. He was doing all these things, and you knew where he's headed. The space program was headed to the moon. Civil rights was headed to passage. Everything was going to come from that. He had an agenda which was broad and rich and wonderful, and the people knew if they got a second term from Jack Kennedy what they were going to get from him. I have no idea what Obama wants to do in the second term. I have no idea what he would do if there was no Eric Cantor or no Tea Party. Would you tell me what you'd do with the fiscal policy of this country? He's never told us. He's never told us what he'd do with long-term debt or reform of the entitlement programs or current fiscal policy if he had his way. Just tell us what you'd do if you had no opposition, Mr. President. Kennedy said the day before he was killed in San Antonio, he talked about the Irish kid who would throw his cap over the orchard wall so he'd have to climb the wall. And he said, we've thrown our cap over the wall of space. When's Obama going to throw his cap over the wall and tell us where we're going? Is it a secret or doesn't he know? And
so
it's a profound problem.
What do you think Obama should ask us for?
I'm not him. I want his answer to what the right fiscal policy. I mean, I think in the long term, debt restraint. In the short term, fiscal stimulus, real fiscal stimulus, massive hiring. I think we're almost at a New Deal situation in terms of hiring. I would find some big national program that young people could volunteer for. I'd keep the people that come back from Iraq and give them new billets at home. I wouldn't muster them out. I'd give them jobs working in education. I'd say, we'll pay you to go to school. I'd keep them moving. I would find ways to employ the abilities of the American people. And I don't want to live at 9% unemployment, 16% underemployment. I don't want to live like that. So I don't think it's good for our spirit, and I'd do something about it pretty dramatically. And it would be called left-wing, but, you know, you ask me what you do, I'd do it. I think this laissez-faire politics isn't working. I think Marx had a lot of truth in the fact automation leading to unemployment. I think it's a real problem. I think we're massively underemployed because of automation and international competition. We're facing a 2 billion person world market for labor out there. We're competing in that labor market, and we're not doing well in that. You know, I think there's a lot of things we've got to do. We have to think radically. But he probably doesn't want to say it. I don't know what he wants to do. Do you?
No.
I know what some of the lame guys on the other side want to do. Nothing. Romney's saving his oats for greatness. I don't know what he's going to do. It could be anything. He's pretty limber. He could do just about anything. He's done just about everything left and right. He's like a metronome. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what he wants to do. I assume he cut taxes on business. I mean, something really, you know, really
There's
majestic.
A new idea.
I don't know. That might work, too. I don't know. Something. Tell me what you're going to do. But so, there aren't that many things you can do with fiscal policy anymore. And I'm not, you know, macroeconomics has not had a good couple of years now. I mean, Keynes hasn't had a great ride. Monetary policy can't go much further than it's going. I mean, interest rates are nothing. And, you know, QE3, I don't know.
And it's not just
How
us.
How far can you go?
It's not just us.
I know we've got a world. We've got every day I call my broker and I see me lose a year's savings. Every once in a while I do go through that every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks I lose a year's savings. I said, how am I going to keep working? Because I lose a year in a day. So I don't know why I keep doing this. I always say, I'll quit now. Every time I bounce this back, I say, I'm quitting now. I'm getting out of this thing. Everybody probably says, I'm getting out of that market now. Damn market.
So,
but the problem is we don't know what the fiscal policy can do. We're running about a $1.7 trillion deficit. It's not working. It's not stimulating because people are rightfully rational and working down their debt ratio. What they have in debt is too high compared to what they're making, and they're making a rational decision, business making rational decisions. And we have so much real estate below the waterline. I mean, we know the problems. It's just, I don't know.
So we're talking, in effect, about whether there will or will not be a second Obama term, and if so, what will it ask of us? So let's go back to magic. Would Kennedy's magic after 1964, were he to have been reelected, would he have been able to be as effective in that second term as Lyndon Johnson was?
Well, I think Johnson had the grieving of the country going for him and the sense of guilt that everybody felt, certainly people on the right. I was on the right as a kid. I felt it. And anybody on the other side must have felt, well, we better give them a break. And I think Johnson was able to win the good heart of Everett Dirksen. And just remember, there's only two Republican senators, I believe, who voted against civil rights. The Republican Party of 1964 was a moderate party.
Yeah.
It was a northern party, a western party. It wasn't this southern party that it's become. It was the southern Democrats who voted against civil rights. It was a totally different environment. It was a better environment. The Republican Party was a moderate party. It was more like a Pete McCloskey Party, a Northern California Republican Party, Pete Wilson Party. It was just that I think California is one of the few areas besides the Northeast where there is that party that's still left. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Susan Collins and Olympia Snow and Scott Brown are about the last of them on the East Coast. But they were able to move. Johnson was able to exploit that grieving very effectively for civil rights, voting rights, Medicare. But Jack had all that stuff lined up. And he was quite wonderfully impulsive about civil rights. And he stood up to Ross Barnett. And that's where physical toughness comes in, political toughness. Standing up to Ross Barnett with the federal troops, standing up to George Wallace with Nick Katzenbach going down and moving him out of the way in Alabama. What he did against a lot of resistance was really admirable. And, of course, when Mrs. King, he got on the phone with her and fall of 1960 when her husband was arrested and hauled off into the countryside. That was the first time a president really reached out and said, we as a country are for civil rights. And then when he gave the great speech in June of 63, which just said it's as American as the Constitution, as fundamental as the Bible, we have to be for civil rights. It had never been said before.
He said it's a moral issue.
And it had never been said before. Yeah. Yeah. And he did it on national television just like that.
And you're right. Lyndon Johnson, his first big address to the nation after Kennedy's death, said the best memorial that you can give to him is to pass his civil rights bill. So Johnson gets the credit for it, but you're absolutely right. It starts with Kennedy.
Yeah, I think Louis Martin, African-American publisher from Chicago, and Harris Wofford, these are the guys that got to Sarge Schreiber, who was such a great heart, and he got around the Irish Mafia to Jack. And then Bobby went through one of those wonderful epiphanies of his, and from 2 minutes after being enraged that they were blowing the campaign, says, I better call that governor and get him out of jail. And so Bobby was amazing, protean guy. He just grew all the time, you know. What a brother. There's a lot in the book about how Bobby came along in 52 and made Jack. And just what a brother. Yeah. And he was willing to do all the dirty work for him.
Yeah.
You know, Jack would say, get him to go public with that endorsement and keep me out of it. Which means go in the back room with the guy and twist it till he squealed. And he would be so tough. And Jack would say, keep me out of it. And Bobby would look back and say, thanks, Jack. Because he would always look good. He would be the Prince Charming and Bobby would be the ruthless one. But he was always operating under Jack's orders. That's the great part of being Jack.
Bobby's one of the several supporting characters in your story.
Bobby was.
So let's just talk about some of the characters who make these other appearances in your book that Jack.
By the way, none of this has ever been printed before. All this comes out of my ability to get Helen O'Donnell gave me her father's inside scoops on all these inside backroom, real hardball stuff that was. You know, politics is not speeches and debates. I've been working in all these years. Politics is what happens when you don't have a camera. It's all what happens in the back rooms. It's the stuff that you saw during the five-week recount in Florida. Each side working its angle, working its counties, working its edges, never once being on the level, each doing its own thing. Gorsuch will just recount the three counties where I'm going to do well in. Yeah. Good move, Al. Yeah. The court doing its thing. Jim Baker somehow getting cert, you know. I've never figured out how they got that thing, how they got the Supreme Court in there. It's all working your angles and in the back room, and that's what politics is. Working with Tip was like that, you know. It's clean. It's just tough.
Let's invert the telescope here a little bit and talk about how Lyndon Johnson thought of Jack Kennedy. There's a story that I've heard that Lyndon Johnson gave a talk to a group of White House fellows in approximately 1966, and he said something to the following effect. He said, a lot of you fellows want to go into politics someday. You're going to meet a lot of people. You're going to have to size them up in a hurry, because you're going to have to deal with them, and you won't know much about them ahead of time. So there's a couple of things you want to know right away, if you can find it out. One is, did the fellow marry up or marry down?
Yeah.
And the second is, what did his daddy fail at?
Yeah.
That's pretty raw, political politics.
Yeah, I know, he figured
so
out
on those criteria, what did Johnson think about Kennedy?
Well, he always thought that if the mother married down, she wanted the kid to improve the family standards, because she always felt that she was pulled down socially. So the son had to make up for that. So she was going to push the son like mad to overcome the father having brought them down socially. So I knew Johnson's thought like that. And I don't know. Johnson and Kennedy are interesting because they got along decently well. But Kennedy didn't like Johnson's physical presence in the room. He didn't like him there. You know, he just felt creeped out a little bit. There's something. He just felt he always called him the riverboat gambler. He liked the fact he called him landslide when he wasn't in the room because he had won by 87 votes, probably dishonestly. But he sort of liked him because he liked pals. Jack liked these characters, especially Southerners. I mean, he and Teddy had that in common. They were both very copacetic with these Southern characters. They didn't like phony liberals, as they called them. The guys were always giving speeches. Chester Bowles and Stevenson always spouting off some grand, especially Bowles, some grand, grandioso liberalism. They'd say, yeah, I know that stuff. Why are we listening to it? You know, we know that. But he liked the Southern characters. Mm-hmm. So, but Bobby had no time for LBJ. You could tell that. No, it's just not oil and water.
You quote Kennedy in here someplace as saying, quote, I hate the liberals.
That was Ben Bradley said that. He said he hated the liberals. He didn't like pomposity. He didn't like the grandiose liberal statement everybody's always making. He wasn't moving towards the liberal position on everything. In fact, on all the good issues, he was right on them. It just took him a while to get there, and he didn't want to do it with any sort of self-pride. He didn't want to brag about being a liberal. He didn't feel comfortable with that.
Do you think he stole the 1960 Illinois election?
It didn't matter. They would have won it anyway. They didn't need Illinois, but I think dead people voted. But I don't know how many. I mean, it was a 5,000 vote plurality in the state, and there was a lot of downstate thievery, too, I'm told. And if Nixon thought he could have won it on a recount, he would have had a recount. But there were a lot of votes that were burnt right away, so he couldn't have a recount too quickly. But I did do the work on that in my earlier book, and it is true that some deceased participated.
It seems to
but
me.
But some of that corruption goes on. I mean, not much of it in America, thank God. And if I've ever known anybody who was involved with it, I would hate them. But I think there's a little cheating goes on even today, a little bit. But not much, thank God. I don't think much, you know.
It seems after you got over your youthful Goldwater delusion that you've admired John F. Kennedy for a long, long time.
Yeah, well, I think it was civil rights and... We had a lot of good political arguments in my family growing up, and I would be for liberty. I understand completely the almost childish love of Ron Paul for this sort of Ayn Rand kind of thing of liberty, objectivism, and all that stuff. And I understand it. Everybody in the Peace Corps with me read Fountainhead. We all loved the romance of it. But by the time you read Atlas Shrugged, you realized it was an ideology, and it wasn't quite as romantic, and it was all, that woman needed an editor. So as one of my friends at the Peace Corps said, she disproves her own theory. She needed an editor. And this all objectivism, sort of your ego is going to always be right is wrong. That book's about 500 pages too long. You know, and it, just make your point. Who was John, what's his name? I mean, what was the guy's name? John Gault.
Rourke?
John Gault, excuse me. Okay. And we've got some objectivists here. Yeah, John Gault. It was just the first book was so romantic. I loved The Fountainhead. I loved that book.
But was there anything in the course of your research and writing this book that caused you to change your mind in any way about Kennedy?
Well, I think I'm always overwhelmed by the infidelity to Jackie and the cruelty to Jackie. It wasn't just infidelity. It was in your face. I mean, why didn't he come back when she was suffering the miscarriage in 1956 after the convention? Why didn't he come back? Why did he have to be talked into coming back by George Smathers from the south of France when he's over chasing girls? Why did he just make her suffer alone like that? And Bobby said, don't come back because you're just going to cause trouble. She's so mad at you. I wouldn't show up now. But he did it in her face. So why did he bring Mary Meyer around to the White House when he knew that Jackie knew about them? It's tough. It's just rough. And I talked to Bunny Mellon about it. It was Jackie's best buddy. I said, how did Jackie put up with all this? And of course, Bunny's 100 years old, but as sharp as a tack. And Rachel Bunny Mellon, of course, is the daughter of, you know, the wife of the Andrew Mellon and all that money and lives in horse country and has a house in Nantucket right next to ours. Of course, it's much larger when it's right there. She once sent us a card, your next door neighbor to the east. And I said, well, how does Jackie deal with all this, all the infidelity? And she said, first of all, she knew. And I said, how do you know? She said, she told me. She knew all about it. And I said, what was it? She said, well, Jackie, you have to understand, comes from an interesting background. Now, everybody has to realize that we're talking about 50 years ago today. We're talking about Mad Men time, when men ran the show and smoked and drank and hung out and they got away with murder. And the women were at home in the suburbs somewhere and putting up with it. And it was a different time then. And then Jackie was a throwback back to sort of an old money world of Hammersmith Farms and Murraywood and old money. And she was raised, as Bunny said, in the world where the men would separate from the women after dinner and go to the cigars and cognac, and the women would stay together. And the men would, of course, cabal together about their girls and keep all the secrets from the women. And in that interview right after Jack was killed, she said that all men are a mix of a combination of bad and good. Of course, Teddy White was nice to her and transposed it to all men are a combination of good and bad. Very different, bad and good. And what she talked about her mother never trying to do the Freudian analysis, I guess, why he behaved the way he did by saying that his mother never loved him. I guess that's what she's trying to do. But she said that she tied her into the rest of the family, the Bouvier family, which is kind of odd. Remember Gray Gardens, the crazy aunts living up there in the Gray Gardens in Long Island. And she said she was too strange to be small. I sort of liked it because it was so hard to figure. But too strange to be small. She wasn't going to be an upset wife about her husband's dalliances. She was too strange to do that. She said that all the men that would come down the road who wanted Jackie, and she rejected all of them. And she had one guy she was interested in her life, and that was Jack. And she was going to be true to him no matter what. And it's true love. And it just blows me away, the love of that woman for Jack. And right at the end, you see her racing. I have this piece of tape I found. It came out about a year or two ago. I found it. I must be the only person blown away by it. Here's this young, skinny, beautiful woman, 34 years old, the same age that Jack was when he first saw her when he died. She was the same age when he died that he was when he first saw her. So there was an age difference there. And she was just racing after that gurney down at Parkland Hospital. Totally in love with it. It was like Keats. Just in love with this guy. And she did the whole thing with the initials on the Saturn. She knew what he cared about. And she was the one that first got me into the secret of who he was. He's the young, sick kid in bed studying history, studying the Knights of the Round Table. Jack Kennedy, she said, history made Jack. It was really, really out of Camelot, really, because she had this deep primordial notion of Jack was history, a student, a child of it. And that's why he became a great man, because he wanted to be like these guys he read about when he was a sick, lonely kid. And she really got him, I think, as well as anybody. And then Gene told me the same thing about the key to Jack was he was sick. He was always alone and always reading and being an intellectual. He wasn't this, you know, hail fell well met we met in politics, this charming. There was always two Jacks, the deeper Jack and the social Jack. And that pattern of these two personalities, the deep, serious thinker, sick kid who's thinking about important things and the majesty of the past and the possibilities of the future all merging together in his mind and wanting to be a great man like Churchill, my other hero, and very much remote parents raised by in remote circumstances alone, not really being close to their mothers, but wishing their mother. There's a great quote in the book I have where he's just yelling about his mother. What kind of mother are you to keep leaving me alone? You know, yeah. He's like 6 years old yelling at her or writing a note to her. I'm sorry. It's all the great. In the old days, everybody wrote letters so you can actually find this stuff. But my favorite letter is to Inga Benga, his Danish girlfriend, which is about the war and what he thinks of the war. And it's so romantic.
So, Chris, we're coming to the point in this program where we have time for just one last question. So there's one question I think is on the minds of a lot of people. It comes up all the time about Jack Kennedy, what might have been had he lived, and it's the question about Vietnam.
Yeah.
Do you have a view on that, how he would have managed
well,
that?
Well, I could put pieces together, and you can connect the dots. People, as early as 1951 when he visited the Far East, that time when he got sick with Addison's that time, and Bobby saved him, he recognized the power of nationalism, as we all have come to recognize it. People that pay attention to anything recognize that the strongest influence on all of us is our nationhood and the fact that they didn't want the French there and they wouldn't like the Americans there. And he knew the worst thing we could do is put a lot of troops there. He absolutely resisted the Eisenhower talk or Nixon talk of going Operation Vulture, going in there in 54 with atomic weapons to attack the Viet Minh, which would have been absurd. And he said if the French had all the troops in the world, they couldn't have won that war. He knew that they would never win the battle at the Dien Bien with all the troops they had. They would have lost eventually because it's basic mathematics. The people who are going to stay there are going to run the country. And they know they're going to be there when you're gone. So they just have to wait you out. And the same thing with the Vietnam War. They just have to wait you out because in the end, they're going to win, whether they're Taliban or whatever they are, they're going to be there when you're gone. And they know it and you know it. So McNamara, with all his numbers and his metrics, wasn't able to figure this thing out. I don't think Kennedy would have unleashed McNamara to put 500,000 troops in the country. And he also, when one unit commander asked him when he was at sea during some naval exercises with Red Fay, and he was there and he wrote it in his book, he said, Kennedy got the word. They said, there's a commander who would like to take his unit into action because he sees a combat mission they can win. And Kennedy said, tell this guy that if he does this now, I'm cutting the financing for the whole outfit. We're going to cut him out. He wanted to make sure that nobody ever thought of taking our troops into combat in Vietnam. So he was a stickler on that. And Sorensen, you quoted, I mean, Sorensen said, I don't know what he would have done. I know the last speech he gave in Fort Worth, he said, if we leave, the government will fall tomorrow. So he was playing the politics of it. My answer is I don't know. I know that everything that I've read about the guy was elegant, and there was nothing elegant about putting 500,000 troops into Vietnam. That said, 1964 and then 1965 presented a different scenario. If he had to face the fall of that government in Saigon, what would he have done? And he might have been able to paper it over like he did in Laos with a coalition government, maybe. And I think that's what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
That's a hunch.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program as much as I did. The program is brought to you tonight by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. So we'd like to thank, of course, Chris Matthews, host of MSNBC's Hardball and author of Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. And I want to thank you, Chris, for bringing JFK back to life for us tonight.
Thank you.
It was really wonderful. Our thanks also to Professor David Kennedy, the Donald J. McLachlan Professor of History Emeritus at Stanford University. And many thanks to our audience here in Palo Alto and those of you who are joining us on the radio and TV. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion is adjourned. Thank you.